you brought up ADHD earlier, and a lot of, I think that it's up for debate about whether or not to even bother testing people with coexisting conditions like ADHD or autism, dyslexia. What are your thoughts on that? Because it's certainly controversial to even go through with it, because how much do other coexisting diagnoses interfere with the interpretation of results?
Did you know that we used to not test people who had intellectual disabilities until they were 12 because it was too hard? Like, we didn't used to even do hearing tests on people who had intellectual disabilities until they were 12. Like,
things change.
Come on, audiology. No, just kidding. So here's the deal. If you are a parent of a person who has ADHD, who is autistic, who has other things going on, you want to make their lives as good as you possibly can. Now, the ADHD gumballs look a lot like the jelly beans of auditory processing disorder. But if you reduce the evidence of auditory processing disorder for these people, it can make their lives a whole lot better. I am an audiologist. I'm not a psychologist. I cannot do things outside of auditory skills. But if I see auditory skills that are lacking in a person who has these other things going on, I sure as heck can measure it and I can improve it. And why shouldn't I? I think that audiology has used some things as a cop-out. And I think it's actually made our profession worse. I think when people say, I won't test somebody who has autism. Well, let me just tell you right now, I train audiologists how to do this testing and treatment. And one of the audiologists, like before we even start teaching them how to do this work, I test them first. There was an audiologist, I tested his auditory processing and it was so severe. And he's also autistic. Should we test him? Of course we should test him. He's a human who has problems, who wants help. And so, you know, I think that it's really tough because audiology has said, oh, nope, I won't test anybody under 7. Oh, I won't test anybody who doesn't have a normal audiogram. Oh, I won't test anybody who is neurospicy. Who are these people testing? It's like such a small portion of the population that meets all of those criteria. And I think it's because audiology hasn't known what to do with those clients once they get the results, you know? I had a clinic that told me that they were only giving a piece of paper as therapy and suggestions to every person who got the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And because so many people who came to them got the diagnosis, instead of doing the testing, they just started handing the paper out. Can you imagine if we did that with hearing loss? You know, I'm not even going to test your hearing loss. Look at people's lips when you're talking. Like, are you freaking kidding me? What?
There's more we can do.
How have we taken, like when it comes to hearing loss, we're like, oh, of course we're going to do something about it. And we're offended when people don't want to do something about it. But then with auditory processing, these people want the help. And we're like, yeah, have this piece of paper.
Frustrating, and it's so challenging for those patients and those families. And I think that's part of the reason why they so value the service when they come for it, and when they get it, is because there's just not the information that they need so accessible, and we can be the ones to provide that if we're doing the work.
Absolutely. There are more people doing the work now, thank goodness. And I do have an online map where people can search for clinics who are doing the work, and they can filter and see who's testing under 7, who's doing therapy, you know, what therapies are they using. And they don't have to just use Buffalo Model. I happen to use it because I think Jack has like 80 to 90% of auditory processing on lock. He knows how to test for it. He knows how to treat it. And for me, it works. Like you said, what about the patients that come in with symptoms where you don't see the test results? That doesn't happen with Buffalo Model. If a person has the problems, you see the problems, and then you can also see the solutions to those problems.
So in this idea of the jelly beans, one of the things that we talk about within our practice and with our students is unpacking the history, that the patient is trying to communicate to you what their experience is. Are you then understanding it the way they intended? Are they conveying to you what they think they're conveying? So if we're not sure if that jelly bean is red or blue, in, as an example, a child who comes in for auditory processing evaluation, who's also autistic, who complains of listening in the cafeteria. So as the audiologist, do we know, is it that it's more misophonia related where the child can't tolerate the sensory input, or is it that with this competing sound, they can't understand speech? So that then becomes frustrating and we can't necessarily unpack it with our patient. It leads to interesting conversations of, hey, I could make one recommendation for you, which could be a low gain hearing aid, or I can make another recommendation for you, which could be a musician earplug that's going to be filtered. Two opposite ends of the spectrum, treating two completely opposing things coming from the same set of symptoms. What do you do in that case?
So I've got a privilege that a lot of audiologists have not, and that's that I do auditory training. And so for me, tacitly, I believe that anything that improves significantly after auditory training must be that auditory processing piece. So because auditory training, we do it 1 hour a week for 12 to 14 weeks. So not a lot of time in, you know, in reference to someone's life. So a round of therapy is about that long. So on retest, we check with the parents, what has changed? Like, what are you noticing improvements in? How much improvement are you noticing? And then we also, to check the test result, jelly beans, and then the, or the symptom result, jelly beans, but then also for the test result, jelly beans, I want to see what is happening in speech and noise. How much is that improving? Has it improved? And so I think that it's really important. For me, it's nice because I'm seeing this person once a week for 3 months, it allows me to see their case in a deeper way because I'm seeing how they're responding to things. Are they doing this? Are they looking scared? Are they frustrated? Like, so for me, I can tease that out because I have a longer relationship with these clients than just 1 hour.
You have the luxury of time and the establishment of rapport.
Absolutely. And I can troubleshoot those things. I think one of the issues that we have in audiology is we have to figure out so much in a single session about a person that it puts a lot of pressure on us that's really kind of unfair. And I think some people think that if we're doing this kind of work over 3 months, that we're wasting a person's time. Like, we're just bringing them in every week to counsel them. Like, what you need to do is have realistic expectations. Like, by the way, I freaking hate the idea of realistic expectations. I think audiologists use it as a cop-out. Just be like, this person wasn't realistic enough. Like, if I went into a gym and I told a trainer, hey, I want to have a hot rocking body. And they're like, I would like you to have realistic expectation. I'd be like, you know what? I'm going to need a different coach. I don't think anyone would respond to, I think you need to have realistic expectations on how hot your body could be. Right? Like legit. Like, I would say that person apparently doesn't know enough. I'm going to go to someone who can get me them gains.
Yeah, it's one of the complications in working with people. Any service-related job is to get the person what they need, have them understand the work that they need to do to get the outcome they want to achieve. Because you could want to have that hot body and also want to drink six cans of Coke and eat a pizza every day, and you're not going to get there. But
you're right.
You could want you're that right. body and want to do the work to get there. Hey, good chance you're going to be successful. So yes. It's important. I think the idea of realistic expectations, I think that's a tricky one because it can be a cop out. But I also think that we work with a lot of cochlear implant patients, and we'll explain to them the work they have to do to achieve success with the device, that, hey, your surgeon can do a great job, but your therapy for this is listening. Your therapy is keeping this device on and understanding your sound environment and asking questions when you don't know what it is that you're hearing. that's your responsibility. You need to do that work. And hey, we can help you get a good outcome if you're willing to do the work. But it doesn't matter what we do, what your surgeon did for you. If you're not going to do the work, your surgery is not going to be successful. If you want a knee replacement, you're not going to go to PT. You're not going to be successful no matter how good your surgeon was. And
I completely agree and understand. Like, you have to be on the same page. But here's the other thing. Mm-hmm. When something is super hard for you or me or whatever, if you have someone who is walking that journey with you, like I was talking about that auditory training for 12 to 14 weeks, especially if a person has a cochlear implant, like I don't know if you know that I have just released a documentary. Have you guys heard about that?
No, tell us.
Tell us about it.
Yeah. So it's about Matt Hay, who has an auditory brain stem implant.
Yes, I did see that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So the documentary is about auditory processing and hearing loss. And what we are doing is we're demonstrating it through showing an example. And the example is Matt Hay. And for each, like, I'm hoping that this is a pilot for maybe 6 episodes. Mm-hmm. And so we'll pick a different case study for each one of those episodes. So basically, the spicy thing that I say in this is that if we got a prosthetic limb, if you, let's say that you had a prosthetic limb put on, and if somebody just gave you an app to learn to walk again, and then they're like, you got to do this work, like, how would you feel about that? Because I would personally be quite angry. I think that audiology, we've put so much effort and thought into the surgeon, the surgery, the programming, and then we just push the client off on their own. Like, how many adults with normal hearing sensitivity advocate for themselves when they mishear something? They don't.
Very few.
Like, even in audiology conferences, when people don't use a microphone and nobody can hear, nobody's throwing their hands up, right? Like, we are requiring these clients to do more than we do. And so I'm so sorry I'm being so spicy.
We love it.
And chili pepper morning.
It's what we like.
It's important to spark conversation.
Yeah, it's important for people to hear this because there's not just one way to do things. And also, we talk to our students about right-wrong differences versus style differences. And clinicians can practice differently and it be perfectly fine, but you have to be right in what you're doing. You have to be doing it properly and correctly. So there can be a right-wrong difference and there can be a style difference. And style differences are okay. Doing it incorrectly is not.
And you know what? I'm going to add a third choice there. Helpful, unhelpful.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Are you helpful with your patient or are you not?
Yeah. Are you helping them move forward or are you not helping them move forward? And I think there are a couple different things there. I think, like with Matt Hay, we could look at the fact that he was understanding like 68% of what he was hearing in quiet on the hint in noise tests. And we could be like, he is smashing it. He's doing way better than most people with auditory brainstem implants. And we could be like, it's good enough, right? But he is living a very fast-paced life. Like, Channing Tatum has literally bought the rights to make a feature film of his life. Like, this dude is out there doing things. Mm-hmm. Can he, like, if his word recognition and quiet improved, what else would that do for his life? And isn't it worth being limitless? Like, and so I think it's tough and it is a balance, right?
So how then would you advise a clinician to shift their mindset from, hey, we took you from 0 to 68, you're kicking ass, to how can we keep going? How do I help you keep going? What tools are in my belt to help you keep going?
I love this. Such a good question. Okay. Fantastic. For me personally, I use questionnaires to help figure that out. All right. So I love the HHIA, although I don't like the title, the Hearing Handicap Inventory for Adults. I call it the 1970s. HHIA, but I just call it the Hearing Inventory for Adults because I'm like, just poof that word. And there's Question number 8, does a hearing problem make you, or do you feel handicapped by a hearing problem? I changed that to,
I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humor. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Do you feel disadvantaged by a hearing problem? Much better. Mm-hmm. And it still makes it valid. I use that questionnaire to see how a person is tracking. And that questionnaire tells me if I have done enough. And I have a whole like tutorial on how I utilize it. So I'd be happy to share that for you guys to share in the show notes. Okay. If anybody is interested in it, they can even do it on themselves to see, all right, am I where I want to be? So there's that questionnaire. That questionnaire gives me a really quick snapshot. It takes about 2.5 minutes to do. And it tells me, have I done enough? And we should be doing this with every single person before and after hearing aid fitting, cochlear implant fitting, auditory processing testing, any intervention we do, we need to see, is it making a change to a person's day-to-day life? That's for adults. So anyone like 18 and over, I would be using that questionnaire. Or there's also a questionnaire called the SSQ-12. I'm sure you use the SSQ-12 quite a lot in your clinic. It's the speech and spatial quality is of life. What is it? The speech, spatial, and qualities of hearing scale. That's it. So there's a 12-item questionnaire, and that tells you how a person's skills are doing. I use those questionnaires to the degree that most people would use an audiogram. Like, I need to have an audiogram as well. I like to compare what's happening on the audiogram to those, but those tell me, have I done enough? Mm-hmm. Because if those scores aren't where they need to be, it means I need to be doing more.
And for the clinician who feels like they don't know what the next step is, where do you advise them to go to develop that skill?
Okay. You don't have to know everything. You just need to know someone who knows what you don't. Mm-hmm. Right?
How do you find that person.
And I think it is really hard to think that if you don't know how to do something, that maybe it just doesn't exist. But there's like a whole big group of us who are moving the needle, who are trying to shift what auditory processing looks like. So there is an APD map, and it's at apdsupport.com/APD map. And I can put that in the show notes. I'll say it one more time. APD, A as in apple, P as in Paul, D as in donut. I know it's supposed to be Delta, but I like donut better. Support.com, and it's APD map. On there, it's an online listing for anybody who's doing this work in the world who are audiologists and SLPs, because only audiologists can diagnose, but audiologists or SLPs can treat. I'm holding that space for audiology so hard. So there are people there who do that work. So find the clinician near you who's already doing it. If there's no one there, do it. Get in it. Get amongst it. I think I saw there are about 20 people in New Jersey doing this work.
There's a lot of places to go for auditory processing evals here.
30 in New York. But still, compared to your population, if 5 to 10% of the people have this issue, it's still quite a good spot to go.
And most places aren't offering therapy for it.
Yeah.
Right. Testing, but they're
almost not.
And you know what? Around us. I feel badly for all of those people because they don't get to see the resolution of the problem. Can you imagine only doing hearing tests and not fitting hearing aids? You know, like it is, especially because some clinics do this, they'll do a 3 or 4 hour long APD evaluation, which is terrible.
Yes.
By the way, that is so mean for the client and the clinician.
And multi-session, and it's not.
Coming back for it.
I mean, and those clients don't want to come back for therapy. They are no longer your fan. Let me just tell you right now, you have put them through heck. You know?
It's almost like a child that if you push them a little bit too far with the hearing test, you're never getting a retest.
Never, right? And Jack Katz says like so many intelligent things all the time, and it like influences everything I do in my life. He's like, he said, catastrophic reactions are to be avoided at all costs. And I think most children who have, if a child does not have auditory processing disorder, go ahead, test them for 4 hours. They're not the kids you're probably seeing in your clinic. If you are testing them for 4 hours, you are being mean. You do not need to do that. I think people do that because they are afraid they're not getting enough test result jelly beans.
To be thorough in the name of being thorough.
Right. They're trying to be thorough. And instead, they are probably missing the point.
And or even skewing the results.
Right. Because then if they're fatiguing over time, they're becoming less reliable.
You got it, sis.
I have a question. It's a little personal question in that I've never been diagnosed with auditory processing disorder, but when I was first learning about it in school and they had, you know, one person tests, the other person takes the test, I bombed the SSW, bombed it. And now that I administer it, I know the words. So is there a way for an audiologist such as myself or the general population of audiologists, can they be accurately assessed for auditory processing if they already know the test battery?
Okay, so let's say, because this is actually an area of interest for me, is audiologists who have auditory processing disorder, because there's a lot of us, my friend, a lot. Welcome to the crowd. What I would do, let's say, Michelle, you came to me and you're like, Angela, I want to get to the bottom of this. What I would say to you is, Michelle, let's do some tests. Let's do tests you're not used to. Let's do tests you've never heard before. I want to gather as many test results, not in 3 hours, but, you know, I want to gather test results, and I want to see the problems you're telling me you have. And then once I see what those problems are, I want to come up with a treatment plan. We're going to treat it. And then when you come back, we're going to retest and we're going to see where you're at. We're going to see how you're doing on those questionnaires, and we're going to see how you're doing on those tests. And there are so many auditory processing tests that no matter what an audiologist has used in their past, I can almost guarantee that I can find something that will challenge you enough that I will be able to measure the problem you are telling me you have. I have no problem. I have confidence in knowing that I can do that.
Okay. So it doesn't have to be doing an SSW.
No. It doesn't have to be doing an SSW. An SSW is still a beautiful thing. And you know what Jack says? He'll say, because he'll use his own tests on himself. And he'll be like, Angela, I'm just going to be honest. And so we'll use some of his tests on, and he'll say, I know that this item is supposed to be that, but this is what I heard. And I think that's really interesting. So test retest. If you've done the SSW 70,000 times like I have, yeah, maybe you're not going to get a lot of information off that. But maybe we do the randomized dichotic digits test for you. Maybe we do the new test that Sound Scouts has come up with for the dichotic test. There's the dichotic offset measure. There are so many tests we can use. I want to use the tests that are going to give me the most information about you.
Makes sense.
Awesome. There's hope.
Of course there's hope. Of course there is hope. Like, this is the most exciting part of audiology. It has so much hope. It has so much potential. I had this guy message me this week, and he said, I feel like a balloon that is healing, hitting the ceiling, and I want to find a place to bounce higher. And I'm like, dude, the sky is the limit. And he was like, you think this is my next lily pad? I'm like, jump, frog, jump. Jump, frog, jump.
You know, as you're saying that, it makes me think of a theme we've had throughout this podcast, which is asking people how they've become a part of other people's stories. Or as I'm listening to you, I'm kind of hearing Jack Katz as a part of your story. Are there instances that you can look to where you feel like there was a connection where you got to become a part of somebody's story that occurred in a meaningful way for you. That was one of those like, this is why I do it moments.
You know how I told you that we work with people once a week for 3 months? Mm-hmm. I would say almost every single person that I have worked with in that kind of way, every kid, every adult, all of them have added richness to my life. Matt Hay, I met with him. We did some work just as friends. I was like, can I do the same kind of therapy that I do with kids who have normal hearing sensitivity and auditory processing disorder? Can I do it for an adult with an auditory brainstem implant? And can it change his life? And can it improve his life? When that went well, he introduced me to two more friends. And so now I have clients, we call them Lola and Beyonce. Beyonce is not actually Beyonce. I forget to mention that sometimes. And people are like, you're working with Beyonce? I'm like, not the same Beyonce. And so I've done 28 sessions with each one of these. And now they're together in group therapy. Mm. The friendships that I have with these people are some of my favorite friendships in my life. The journeys that I have gotten to be a part of. Like it almost makes me want to tear up. Like I have seen kids who have been severely abused. I have worked with people who have had traumatic brain injuries, like a pilot that the windscreen went into his skull. Oh, man. Like, there are people who have had 10 sets of grommets. Or even people who have been nonverbal, who are starting to say speech sounds. Like the richness that I have in my life beyond hearing aids in audiology, if more people knew about that, everybody would be jumping into this. Mm-hmm.
That's what we're wanting to share, those stories, because whether it's cochlear implants, auditory processing, even hearing aids, the ability to impact people in such a positive way is something to be shared, something for people to understand and realize that's why we do this. That's why we're working with our patients. And the greater number of patients as the clinician you can get that experience from, the more rich and rewarding the work becomes.
This work feels meaningful. And I'm not going to lie to you. There have been a lot of pressures in audiology. Audiology has gotten somehow like trapped in this vicious cycle that's really hard to get out of, where, you know, we have such high costs and such low reimbursement. And then there's the OTC thing happening. And like, it is so nice to step out of that completely and be like, you know what? I can make money without the lights even being on. Right. And I think being able to have meaningful work, even in private practice, can be very, very hard because the struggle and the hustle is real. Mm-hmm. And I think that audiology is waiting for that place where they can bounce higher. And I see it. And I have lived this life for 20 years. And I can tell you that it is worth it. It is rewarding. And the clients freaking love it.
It's the old saying, if you do something valuable, people will value it.
For the audiologists listening out there, whether they currently do auditory processing, if they're looking to start with auditory processing, what's the thought you want to leave them with? How should they be looking at their cases?
I am not the only person who trains people how to do auditory processing work. Let me just be clear. There are lots and lots of us online who are running online courses, in-person courses. We've got Heidi Allen in South Africa running her CAPMAT course. Liz Lee with her adult APD, Deborah Moncrief runs some things, Nina Kraus has some stuff, the International Guild of Auditory Processing Specialists hold things as well. So jump online, find someone who you resonate with, find a mentor who can help you along the way. Because just like, I mean, it's a little bit meta, right? The client needs a clinician who can walk them along the journey, take them from where they're at to where they need to go. And those of us who are mentoring in the space are doing the same thing with clinicians. Find the person who can take you from where you're at to where you want to go and be relentless in that pursuit. Because
such
honestly,
valuable advice.
Thanks, mate.
So one last thing I wanted to ask about, as I listened to your TEDx talk, which I believe had well over a million views at this point. So in the beginning, you're introducing your own personal story. And I have to be honest, as I'm listening to that, at first, I'm hearing it as a metaphor for auditory processing disorder. I actually thought that's where you were going with it. I did not realize that was your story. I thought it was a means of illustrating what it is that you're going to get into, what it is that you try and help your patients along with. And actually went and searched it up further to figure out what was it? How did I miss something within that? And within your own personal story, your own personal experience, how is that informed the way you walk somebody on their journey? Because you've had your journey that you needed to find your way through. How has that guided you with the people that you work with?
Thank you. It's a really, really good question. And I understand that you are also a foster parent. Is that correct?
Yes.
And how many foster kids have you
had
in your life?
Just one. And we had a pretty easy situation where he came to us when he was just a few days old and we since adopted him. But
my goodness. That is amazing. That is so incredible.
So I always say we had it easy because a lot of the stories have a lot more complications than his did.
And, you know, I will say from a place of privilege, I had it easy because the first 10 years of my life were quite normal. Well, not totally normal. I mean, I was born into a commune and but the commune was excellent. Not at all weird. Mennonites. I was born into a Mennonite commune. Isn't that wonderful? Okay. Yeah, I know. Next TEDx talk. That was a very good experience, though. I have uncles and aunties and cousins who are not related to me. That was wild. My first 10 years were full of people who loved me, mm-hmm. who let me know who I was. Then from the ages of about 11 to 17, I went through pretty severe abuse and trauma. So my dad and my stepmom decided to lock me in their basement. I wasn't talked to. I wasn't touched. I didn't talk on the phone with people. I couldn't watch TV. There wasn't running water down there. There were just buckets. I was alone all the time, and I'm a very, very social person. So being alone that much, I tried to befriend a cricket down there. It was just annoying. It was not very Disney that.
Not Jiminy.
There was a long period of time where I sat alone with my thoughts while other children are learning how to socialize. And let me tell you, after social and rehabilitative services realized this issue and pulled me out of the basement, January 1999, I ended up going to college in August of 1999, months later. I went to college a complete weirdo. Can you imagine? I feel like I honestly should probably text message the chick who was my first roommate. She had to share a really small room, a room smaller than this with me. I didn't even know how to live upstairs. Anyway,
you missed pretty critical years.
I did. I was a total weirdo. I mean, I am still weird. I am still weird, but it is okay. I am okay. I am happy in my own skin as a weirdo now, because when I was at KU, the University of Kansas, it was $5 per session to go to their psychology unit, right? So I could go have therapy. And the very first session of therapy was with a student clinician. I never had another student clinician the rest of the time I was there. I went to school for 10 years at the University of Kansas. I just went every week. I'm like, why not? Right? Best therapy ever. But then when I graduated, I was like, wait, I can't go to my talking lady? uh-oh, that sucks. Anyway, that was a random side jaunt. Mm-hmm. How does my experience of being alone, feeling trapped, feeling unheard, feeling unloved, how does that inform my day-to-day work in every way? I'm really glad that I'm not a sociologist or a social worker. I think that would be too close. I think that would be very triggering and very hard. But I think there were lots of ways in which, because my parents were teachers, elementary and middle school teachers, and I was in high school at the time in our small town. I would have to crawl out of a window to go to school. They made me go through the window. It wasn't like I was escaping. I would go through the window and I would walk to school while they drove past me. Weird. Mm-hmm. And there was something about when I would be at school where I was around a lot of people, but I still felt alone. And I think that's the lived experience with a person who has auditory processing disorder, because they are trapped and they're stuck and they don't know how to get out. And that's how I felt, trapped, stuck, and I didn't know how to get out.
Was that feeling of aloneness more intense when you were with people than when you were with yourself in that time period?
I would say absolutely not, but that's because I was so relieved to be around someone else. I mean, like literally the 3 months during summer
of just escaping.
Oh my gosh. And just feeling almost normal. Feeling human. I felt human when I was around other people. When I was not, when I was locked in the basement, I felt like an animal. I felt like, yeah, I didn't feel human, which is a horrific feeling. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the ways in which it also helps me understand how people who have been in previously underrepresented cultures and communities and whatnot, like, I get it. Like, I've been treated worse than a dog, and I've been treated like a dog someone doesn't like. And I don't want to go back there, right?
Absolutely. And is it a topic that with something like auditory processing disorder and how somebody can feel the lack of understanding what it is they're experiencing? Hey, they might see a professional and the professional says, hey, but your normal things are fine. And maybe you're walking through your school day and nobody knows what you're going back to. That there's this parallel in what the experience can be of you're living this life that people can't understand and can't see, that you just want relief from. Maybe that, I think that's why I saw the metaphor in what you were saying in the talk, because there's the language you use to describe the experience sounds like people who are experiencing something undiagnosed and untreated are experiencing. And not to downplay or minimize either end of that.
You fully get it. Mm-hmm. You fully get it. That was what I was wanting to, that was the what I wanted people to take away from that is that, you know, I was walking around with something that people didn't know. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to come out of it. Mm-hmm. But now that I'm out of it, there's no way I would go back. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the parts that I actually may not have even really realized until you and I are just talking right now. And, is that people telling me, because my parents were very well respected in our small town. My dad, I mean, back when I was in fourth grade, my dad was my science teacher, and he was one of the most beloved teachers ever. And it was before he had met my stepmom and before all this happened. So he was a very different person back then. And he was one of the best teachers I had ever had. So here we have a small town where hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of people revered my father. And people would say, I know Mr. Laux, he would never do anything like that. Like, that was the same feeling that a client gets when they go into an office where they have their hearing tested and it's within normal limits.
You feel so unseen.
You feel unseen. You feel unheard. And I even had, I worked at a pet hospital, like walking dogs and stuff during that time, which, by the way, all of that money got taken by them. It's fine. Anyway, but there would be a couple hours right after school where I would walk these dogs. And my boss at that time said, parents need to find whatever way that they need to discipline their children. And I went home and I told my foster mom that. And she said, I'll be right back. And she was like, you will not be returning to that place of work. she was like, I will not have that for my kid.
How did you get to that line of work? We always talk about there's always a reason. And yeah. I'm curious about that.
The line of work of being in a pet hospital?
Yes.
Because it happened to be walking distance from my parents' house. And so, which, you know, like in some ways I really enjoyed it because, yeah, I got to be around something. Oh, can I tell you a secret? Oh my God, my stepmom will be so pissed if she hears this. But there was one time where they went away for a couple weeks and they literally brought down 2 loaves of bread and a jar of peanut butter. And they said, we're going to be going away for a while, make this last. And they just left, right? And so it was during summer. So I would, and only during the last couple years was I able to go work at this clinic. So most of the time for the first few years during summer, I didn't leave the basement at all. Like literally sitting there staring at a wall. Not good. But there was this one time they left and I like went to the clinic and there was this puppy. There's this cutest little puppy. And so I smuggled it home. I took it back with me. I'm like, I don't think they're coming home today. I was just playing with this puppy all day. And furthermore, they had this amazing garden because they cared more about plants than people. Mm-hmm. They had this amazing garden. I pillaged it. I ate fresh tomatoes and watermelon. Very hard to eat a watermelon when you don't have any implements. But I am telling you, it was like the best. It was like, you know, have you seen that movie, The Secret Garden, where it's like, that's what I experienced.
That is quite the adventure. Finding the bright spots in a time of a lot of darkness.
For sure. For sure.
It's a fascinating, your story is a fascinating story and how that's taken you to help so many people and help people, because in training clinicians, you have the downstream effect of helping the people that they help. So it just sounds like you're bringing a lot of positivity out into the world and it's a wonderful thing.
Can I just throw it back though? Like, I think a lot of people think that Jack Katz's best work is The Clinical Handbook of Audiology, and it is a great book. All of us, you know, we can carbon date ourselves based on the color.
What color
the cover was.
Mine's green.
People think I was green too.
Nice.
Michelle, which one are you?
Remember?
What?
Hold on. I gotta go back and look. You know, I just
were books
over
digital by your time?
Yeah, mine was over COVID. I think that if we got a PDF, okay, it's the purple one.
Well, there was light purple and there was dark purple, so that's okay. I'm going to guess that you were dark purple. I'm in this one, and I'm in the next one. It's very exciting. Number 8 is being written right now.
Awesome.
So let me just say that a lot of people think that those clinical handbooks are Jack's best work, and it's not. His work in auditory processing disorder is going to completely inform the future of audiology. And I mean, it's like, get in now or get in later, because this is where that bus is going. Now, what are we going to do to improve those tools? A lot, probably. And what is AI going to do? A lot, probably. Mm-hmm. But I am open to whatever that looks like. But I've got to say that Jack was the one who was doing, what do we call it in the US, where you go and jump in the water? Like a ball. We call it bombs here, but what do they call
cannonball?
Them?
Oh, cannonball.
Cannonball. Jack Katz is the original cannonball. I am just one of the ripples that came after. So I have not created any of this stuff. I'm just taking his stuff to make more people understand it to a deeper level so that they can make those ripples in their clients themselves.
It sure sounds like they are. And it's a wonderful thing.
I heard of you originally through one of our colleagues that has followed you for years and loves your work. So from
who
one
was that?
Clinician, Alexis Conti.
Oh, Alexis Rooney.
Yes.
Yeah, she since got married. Chick. Yeah, she did the API.
Yep, she's amazing.
And when she listens to this, she's going to be thrilled that you just said that.
Hello, Dr. Rooney.
Yes, yeah, she's wonderful. Excellent.
We wanted to leave it a surprise that you were going to be here, the guest for us today.
That's so sweet. I love it. That's so cool.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, sharing your story, getting all this information out about auditory processing, what clinicians can do, what parents can do for their kids, what adults can do to seek further improvement. There's so much there, and there's so much for people to learn on this topic. So let this only be a start for that.
Michelle and Eric, I've really enjoyed our conversation. Your questions have been perfect. I think I really appreciate the fact that I felt really, it's actually really hard for me to talk about my story in a way that's concise or that anybody can understand, but there are ways in which I felt like you were walking that journey with me that made that a lot easier for me today. So I just want to say that podcasting is not easy and you are doing a brilliant job of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just tell everyone where they can find you. Yes. So that if they have questions about auditory processing, want to look into your master's course, where can they find you?
So Auditory Processing Institute is what I call myself. It's actually based off of the Jane Goodall Institute, because y'all know that chimpanzee and great ape thing I love. So the Auditory Processing Institute is an online course. There are two different courses, how to assess auditory processing, and that's for people age 3.5 to 100 plus, and also for people who have ADHD, any kind of neurodivergence or hearing loss. And then we have auditory processing, the therapy course as well. And that teaches you how to treat what you've just seen in the diagnosis. And those are only for audiologists. I'm so sorry for those who would love to take this, but it's not in your scope of practice. I get it. I understand why that's frustrating, but also audiology really needs to make sure that we are the ones owning this space, because it would be very easy for someone to miss a hearing loss. So that's how you can find me, auditoryprocessinginstitute.com. You can also reach out to me on LinkedIn or Facebook. I'm on Instagram and all the things.
And your TEDx talk on YouTube.
Yes.
Thanks. And the new documentary called Between Two Ears.
And where can people find that?
So I actually we're about to do an online premiere, which will be a lot of fun. We have just become nominees for the World Film Festival in Cannes. So awesome. Very exciting, and hoping to hit Sundance later this year as well. So you can find that. I'll put the details through my Auditory Processing Institute Instagram page.
Perfect.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I know that I started this conversation by saying that auditory processing is my favorite branch of audiology. Now I know why, and I only love it more. So thank you for all of your insight, all of the information you've provided for us and for our listeners. And we look forward to seeing all the stuff that you continue to do to enhance this part of the field.
Let's go.
All right, Dr. Alexander, thank you so much for being on the Hear Us Out podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.